The following is a lecture on the Vyasa Puja Day of His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, given on December 19, 1999, in Innisfail, Ireland.
Since we met last year for this Vyasa Puja, the GBC at their annual meeting passed some resolutions about a Guru Tattva, and I'd like to mention some of those, not to cite law book, but because I thought they were very clarifying and appealing. There were research from Prabhupada's books, and much of it was presented in a book also by Shivaran Maharaj called the Shiksha Guru. And the foundational principle is that all spiritual masters are Shiksha Gurus because they give instruction. And that starts with Lord Krishna, who is the Adi Guru, or the first Guru. He teaches, for example, in Bhagavad Gita, and he teaches through all other Gurus. So he's the Adi Guru, but a kind of Shiksha Guru. He's also the Guru in the heart. He's got another name, Chaita Guru. And then another kind of Shiksha Guru, but very important, is the founder Acharya, who starts a particular line of Vaishnava Sampradaya. Of course, there are four Vaishnava Sampradayas, but as a branch of the Brahma Gaudiya Sampradaya, ISKCON is something distinct, and so we consider Prabhupada a founder acharya of, and not only consider, but he is, by fact, founder acharya of this particular branch of the Gaudiya, Brahma Gaudiya Madhva Sampradaya. So all members of this movement, ISKCON, or Hare Krishna movement, they all accept Srila Prabhupada as their founder, acharya, guru. He's their guru. So if over the years there was any neglect of this concept while after Prabhupada's disappearance, that should be corrected, and we should understand that for everyone, Prabhupada is their, as the GBC put it, preeminent Shiksha Guru. And that means that we have direct access to him, especially through his books, and that anyone who is any kind of our guru now should be representing him. The thing that all the gurus are teaching, starting with Krishna, is Divya Gyan, or as in this Divya Gyan Vide Prokasito, that song to the guru, the knowledge of Krishna consciousness which liberates us from birth and death, by which we can go back to Godhead. So we emphasize that rather than magical powers that a guru may have when we talk about whether someone is qualified for guru. It's the knowledge, it's the process that liberates, and he who gives us that knowledge, who guides us in that knowledge, is our guru. Recognizing Shiksha Gurus can be, it is a multiple, there are many Shiksha Gurus, and so anyone who helps us in this, who gives us the Divya Gyan, is a Shiksha Guru. But Prabhupada is special. A little bit of a digression. In the last few weeks, I've been listening again to the tapes of Prabhupada lecturing in 1966. I so much like those tapes in particular. There are all kinds of little things I hear on them from time to time that have to do with a particular place and situation. And reminds me of those times. Sometimes I even hear myself reading out a verse that he wanted read, and other sounds and things happening. And those are accessible to anyone. I remember I was present at the reopening of 26 Second Avenue some years ago, when it was obtained by ISKCON and remodeled, and it was a reopening. It was jam-packed by devotees and everything, and different devotees were asked to speak, and it was a wonderful occasion, but I couldn't really relate so much to that space being 26 Second Avenue. They had remodeled it so much, and there it was, whatever it was, 1990 something or other, and it was a different scene. And I thought, though, that the reality of 1966 was existing for me in a kind of mental, spiritual space. And in fact, that in the talk that I gave, rather than tell a lot of memories, I told some things that I'd heard on the tapes, which they could hear also. So you can hear those tapes. And in my own life, however, that's a very precious thing for me, the connection that I have to Prabhupada from those days. I can't always come up with some stories. If someone says, what was it like when you first met Prabhupada, or tell us some stories, it's not like my heart is so soft or my memory is so ready that I can come up with them. But just the basic fact that I was there, and I know it wasn't a hallucination. It was, and it's my roots, which I pray never to uproot by offense. But I guess all I can say is it's very dear to me. And one reason is because, and it's the obvious one, that I was in my material career, my material delusion, and I was taken out. And I feel very proud of it. I heard Prabhupada saying just yesterday, he was talking about dumbha is the word for pride, and how that's a very bad thing. It's one of the qualifications of a demon in the 16th chapter, dumbha. In another place, adumbha is mentioned for the devotee. He's always feeling very low. So after telling in so many ways how dumbha is very bad, even if a Brahmin has it, he said, but if you are proud of being a devotee of Krishna, he said, that is a good thing. So, although he qualified that a little later too, that it shouldn't be a material thing. But I'm certainly proud, and Prabhupada encourages us to be proud. And I'm proud that I was so fallen, and that I was saved by him, by his expert handling. At the same, his very lenient handling. Maybe that's why I tend to be so lenient. And he also said that the acharyas are 80% lenient, and he was so lenient with us. He didn't insist on anything. He just accepted whatever we wanted to do, as long as we chanted Hare Krishna and accepted the affectionate exchanges with him. So I saw what a guru was, and I became a disciple under those conditions. So that's the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, and everything else has been trying to live it out, because from there he sent me to on various missions, and from there I've come to represent him here today. So he's the founder of Charya, Guru. Then there is Diksha Guru, and he's also a kind of Shiksha Guru. Prabhupada says that generally the Shiksha Guru who gives you instructions becomes your Diksha Guru. And he becomes the most prominent of your Shiksha Gurus, aside from the Foundacharya. And this is the standard relationship. It's certainly the relationship as it's developed in ISKCON, and it's not unnatural that there's one guru who inspires you most and from whom you receive the most instructions, and he gives you, you ask him to give you initiation. But they went on to say that there are exceptions to this, the standard. They call the standard the protocol. The exception may be that in the course of time or development or various relationships, you develop a stronger relationship with one of your shiksha gurus, and then you may, I'm sure you're acquainted with this, then by mutual arrangement, with all etiquette still being given to the diksha guru of respect, and with his blessing, you take instruction more prominently from your shiksha guru. So these are some of the clarifications that have been made about the spiritual master in the Krishna consciousness movement. I wanted to next read a letter I received from a disciple. Just about a month ago, he had some bad experiences living in a temple, and although while he was in the temple, he received initiation from me. Now he's living with his wife in a town near another devotee couple. So he says, I've been doing a lot of introspection this year. I have been questioning myself intensely. Who am I? What are my motives for the things I have done and do? One important thing I have come to understand lately is how I feel I have been dishonest with you in how I have portrayed myself to you in our correspondence. Many times I have tried to seem more advanced than I really was, or at times I tried to make you think I was more happy than I was in reality, or that I was more fixed up than I really was. I tried to make you think I was having more deep spiritual realizations than I really was. The fact is, I have had a mostly difficult time during my stay in the temple. So he goes on to say that he especially didn't tell me how he felt he was coerced by the temple authorities because he thought I might see him as unsurrendered. I think I tried to tell you things sometimes to try to impress you. Also, I can see that I've held a sentimental outlook on our relationship, guru and disciple. I tried to see something that didn't really exist, like some kind of unexplainable mystical experience. I feel like ISKCON encourages people to have sentimental relationships. I feel like this is a type of impersonalism. I hope you don't take this the wrong way. I just want to see the naked reality of every situation, so I can be free from illusion and personal motive. Did you ever notice or detect this dishonesty and sentimentalism in me before? Close the window. I am not like some devotees who are bitter about their disappointments in ISKCON. Sometimes they reject their guru and even reject Srila Prabhupada. I still respect you as my diksha guru and feel that I have received genuine spiritual instruction from you over the years and still do. I just don't want to fantasize about some unseen, mystical something or other that isn't really there. How do you view our relationship? How do you view me? Also, even though I am frequently inspired by your writing, what should I do if I disagree with something you've written? Should I bring it up to you for discussion? My material situation seems to be in an unsure state, but I can honestly say I enjoy reading Srila Prabhupada's books. They make things clear. I feel peaceful when I read them attentively. My desire is to someday have a deep understanding of Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy as taught by Srila Prabhupada and to someday have some genuine spiritual realization. So, in replying, I kind of focused on this seeing with naked reality that he wanted to do and also the relationship of the guru. I told him that he really wasn't capable of seeing things with the naked reality or seeing things in their naked reality by the naked eye, especially the things of the other world and the spiritual truths. He wants to really get down and have no more bluff or coercion There's a lot of cynicism here, perhaps by abuse of people assuming that that they know things that nobody else can know because they're in touch with spiritual truths, and then his later thinking that they were bluffing. But now he's lost faith. It appears almost that anybody can represent a truth beyond material perception or beyond his own material introspection. So he's just going to go on his own now, like Madhu Mangal's song, On My Own. So that was one thing. I tried to call him on that naked reality and say that it's really not possible to see. And then also, I defended the relationship of guru and disciple, which he seems to say is just an ordinary thing. I said there is such a relationship that's not like other relationships, that is something that has a different dimension to it than business relationship or even material love relationship. It's not a bluff that there is a representative of Krishna, and we can't know that the dimension of that relationship or what's happening through it in an ordinary way. As Prabhupada says, don't see the guru as an ordinary man. That doesn't mean that the guru should in any way misrepresent himself as having some powers that he doesn't. But he's at the other extreme, and he's saying it's just some hocus pocus to say that I'm your guru, and if I approve of you, God will approve of you, or now I'm telling you something that you should do, and if you do it, Krishna will be pleased, and now you serve me, and if you serve me, you'll be very fortunate. And he's thinking, oh, this is all nonsense. Why is this Khan saying that a guru is a special thing? So I feel he's lost. Certainly in Vedic culture, all the children are taught right from the beginning that the guru and the sadhu is very dear to the Lord by their leading Krishna conscious lives, and if you please them, you please Krishna, and if they speak according to the Vedic teachings, which they practice very carefully, they are special people. So I tried to talk with him about that, but I thought right away when I read this, I thought, oh, I'm going to bring this to the meeting, because this is the negative side in one sense, and this is what I would like to defend, not in an exaggerated way, but live up to, that we do have a relationship which is not ordinary. And that's what we're celebrating today, or observing today. Now, I'd like to read about that. I put it in my own words, but I read it in a purport by Prabhupada about the necessity of a spiritual master and a little bit who he is, from one purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, chapter 135. The author says, I first offer my respectful obeisances at the lotus feet of my initiating spiritual master and all my instructing spiritual masters. And then Prabhupada says, the expert spiritual master knows well how to engage his disciples' energy in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, and thus he engages a devotee in a specific devotional service according to his special tenancy. Those who were here last night, we were talking about this. This is a very pertinent reference of having a special tenancy, and the guru having the intelligence to engage a disciple in that. A devotee must have only one initiating spiritual master, because in the scriptures, acceptance of more than one is always forbidden. There is no limit, however, to the number of instructing spiritual masters one may accept. Generally, a spiritual master who constantly instructs a disciple in spiritual science becomes his initiating spiritual master later on. One should always remember that a person who is reluctant to accept a spiritual master and be initiated is sure to be baffled in his endeavor to go back to Godhead. One who is not properly initiated may present himself as a great devotee, but in fact he is sure to encounter many stumbling blocks on his path of progress towards spiritual realization, with the result that he must continue his term of material existence without relief. Such a helpless person is compared to a ship without a rudder. So this is some proof. It still doesn't prove whether I personally am qualified. So I would like to say a little bit about that, and maybe a little still replying to the letter, and that I try not to be mystifying so-called guru. But one thing I try to do, therefore, is to be very honest about my own position, admitting any lacks, and also to ask that honesty of you. I remember one of my godbrothers putting things in a nice perspective some years ago. The question was going around, as it still is, was so-and-so gurus, were they pure devotees? He said, that shouldn't be the question. The question should be, do we have pure relationships? Are our relationships pure? That's more important. You and I, is there no duplicity in our relationship? Then we're well on the way towards actual purity. That is purity. So I try to have that kind of purity or honesty, or ask that of you, and I try to be pure too, rather than conceive pure of how exalted you are in your meditation on your eternal form in Goloka Vrindavan, or your scholarship of Vedic texts, areas in which I'm not so proficient at all. I thought also of the word honest, and then I thought of the word relevant, that I thought how in a couple of ways. One is that my disciples, I'm not making so many new disciples, but my disciples are growing older. That means also spiritually, they're growing more advanced, they're getting more realizations, they're really reading Prabhupada's books. So how can I be relevant to them? They know the philosophy as well as I do. So that's a kind of challenge for me, to understand the philosophy deeper, to at least keep in touch with it, so that I can be relevant as a teacher. How can a teacher not know even what the students know? Relevant also I took to mean realistic, and in the opposite way of what I just said. I gave you credit for advancing spiritually, which I think you are. As time goes by and as we grow older, you're advancing spiritually, and so you're catching up or maybe passing the guru. And so I have to be relevant and also be a good teacher. But at the same time, I see, frankly, that you're not becoming Maharaj Prakshit, just as I'm not Sukadeva Goswami. So put relevant has a different meaning then, that we have to deal with the fact that there's compromise, that you are sincere, but we're working in a compromise situation, that you're not fully surrendered. But I still have to help you, and from my own honest position too. So this is, call it realism. Not abandoning the scriptures, but trying to see how we can actually help each other when we exchange, when we communicate, that we talk about what really needs to be said, rather than some flowery words that don't touch the heart or don't touch the problems that you have. So I think I could really be a guru in a relevant way if I could help you in your lives in that way, and that you felt you could turn to me, not for material advice, spiritual, but purely, relevantly, realistically. I have something I'd like to read about that relevantly. from a disciple, or he wants to take initiation from me, and he writes me a letter in what I consider the kind of way I can be relevant. He says, you mentioned being committed to the struggle of trying to become a devotee. That quality is something that I immediately noticed and appreciated in your writing, and also something that I found rather attractive. I can't claim to be a pure devotee or even a very good one, so the struggle to become one is really all I have. I enjoy the details of it, of learning to surrender, learning to serve, and learning to do it all with devotion. The fact that I do enjoy the process is what helps me keep in it. If I were to simply go by stunning realizations or spiritual ecstasies, I wouldn't last too long. As you said, it's hard to avoid the ups and downs. It seems like the real chances for advancement lie within the struggle, too. That's where what devotion we do seem to have can come forward, by showing Krishna that we are fixed enough to last through the dry spells. And as long as I can keep that and your instructions in mind during those dry times, I'll be okay. So I do that. I describe my own struggle, and here's a devotee saying, "This is just what he needs. That's where he's at, and he doesn't mind it, because that's the truth of his situation." And then I hope that my writings are relevant, and here's a devotee saying they are. The Among Friends I read immediately upon receiving. The other books I read slowly in between. In Among Friends, I like especially the first part where you deliberate on a certain subject like envy or dealing with our level of Krishna consciousness. Many times it is exactly what I needed to hear. We regularly have here devotee meetings where we read together and speak our realizations. When me or someone else happens to be the leaders of this meeting, we find a gold mine of subjects in these texts. Okay. Now, some of you may have heard one signal or another as to whether I'm going to ask anyone to speak today and what that might be. So first I'm going to discuss this as a subject. I thought about it a lot, going back and forth, thinking, yes, I'd like to ask the devotees to speak homages. No, I won't. Maybe I could ask them to speak something else. I told one devotee, I said, I changed my mind, I decided I won't. And he said, I'm glad you said that because I wasn't going to come if you were. So I realized that not only I have strong feelings, but the devotees have strong feelings about them too. One devotee wrote to me expressing that the dilemma, she felt both of the feelings, and she mentioned it in the context of having those feelings on Prabhupada's Vyas Pooj. On Prabhupada's disappearance day, devotees spoke their realizations, which I liked to hear. I never speak in this forum. I can speak to my Srila Prabhupada Murti. I feel like the public speeches take away the contact with the words I try to express, and it brings it to the false ego platform. At the same time, I wonder if it is wrong not to be able to speak in such a forum, since it is for the pleasure of Srila Prabhupada and the devotees. So she put the pro and the con pretty well there. But I'm going to give two more extended examples of why a person might not want to ask others to speak homages, and the people might not want to speak them to him, praising him, and then speak otherwise. So the example I'm going to read is from Shakespeare's play King Lear, and it's the opening scene. King Lear is a very old king, and he's starting to go crazy in his old age, as evidenced by what he does in the opening scene. He calls his daughters together with their husbands, and he wants them to praise him. And according to how well they praise him, he tells them, he's going to give them that much land. So there's a little opening strategic talk that goes on, but then he comes on and he says, now we shall express our darker purpose. And he makes this proposal. Tell me, my daughters, since now we will divest us both of rule, interest of territory, cares of state, which of you, shall we say, doth love us most, that we our largest bounty may extend where nature doth with merit challenge? Goneril, our eldest born, speak first. Goneril, sir, I love you more than words can wield the matter. Dearer than eyesight, space, and liberty, beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life, with grace, health, beauty, honor, as much as child e'er loved or father found, a love that makes breath poor and speech unable, beyond all manner of so much I love you. Now, to tell you what happens later in King Lear, after he gives out his land, these girls, they didn't love him at all, and they just kick him out. And he expected he'd at least be able to live at their provision. And they all kick him out, and he goes completely crazy, and he wanders. That's the tragedy of their cruelty to him. And a delineation of insanity and old age. It's a very tragic play. So you can understand where Goneril's heart is, although her words are like this. But there's one daughter who actually loves him. And she proves at the end of the play in different ways that she's his benefactor, a well-wisher. So the oldest one spoke first, and now here's the daughter who really loves him. She just speaks an aside. Maybe I should ask Shilavati to speak these. But you know these wonderful asides in the Shakespeare plays, where they're just talking to the audience or thinking to themselves. So she's not speaking to the king, but she knows she's going to have to speak. So Cordelia says, "What shall Cordelia do? Love and be silent." And Lear says, now he's responding to Goneril, what she said, "Of all these bounds, even from this line to this, with shadowy forests and with champions riched, with plenteous rivers and wide-skirted meads, we make thee, lady, to thine and Albany's issue, be this perpetual." What says our second daughter, our dearest Regan, wife to Cornwall? Speak. So this is really kind of a mad proposal to ask. You can just see them, the better they speak, the more they get. So this is one kind of eloquence. So she says, "Sir, I am made of the self-same metal that my sister is, and prize me at her worth. In my true heart I find she names my very deed of love, only she comes too short, that I profess myself an enemy to all other joys which the most precious square of sense possesses, and find I am alone felicitate in your dear highness's love." Now Cordelia says aside, "Then poor Cordelia, and yet not so, since I am sure my love's more richer than my tongue." Now King Lear says to the second daughter, "To thee and thine hereditary ever remain this ample third of our fair kingdom, no less in space, validity, and pleasure than that conferred on Goneril." Now, actually he loves Cordelia, you see, he already loves her the best. Now he turns to her. "Now, our joy, although the last, not least, to whose young love the vines of France and milk of Burgundy strive to be interest. What can you say? to draw a third more opulent than your sisters. Speak. Cordelia, nothing, my lord. King Lear, nothing? Cordelia, nothing. King Lear, nothing will come of nothing. Speak again. Cordelia, unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, nor more nor less. King Lear, how, Cordelia, mend your speech a little, lest you may mar your fortunes. Cordelia, good my lord, you have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back as are right fit. Obey you, love you, and most honor you. Why have my sisters husbands if they say they love you all? Haply, when I shall wed, that lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Sure, I shall never marry like my sisters to love my father all. So actually she has said something wonderful, but he doesn't take it that way. He says, King Lear, but goes thy heart with this? Cordelia, aye, good my lord. King Lear, so young and so untender? Cordelia, so young, my lord, and true. King Lear, and then he curses her that she should get nothing. So, if I'm in that mood that I want to... take pleasure in some kind of false ego recitation of hearing, oh Gurudev, you're so wonderful, you have these qualities and that qualities. It doesn't seem to be the humble position. And so I can understand that some devotees feel like that, a little bit like Cordelia, that I'll show, I don't want to, in front of others, say how I feel. However, the very dilemma has been addressed by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in that famous talk, which I think I read last year and the year before. I probably read every year because it's so right on. And I'll read that as he was on a Vyasa Puja day speaking to his disciples. We have taken upon ourselves the responsibility of welcoming this grave charge. All the audience have accepted ordinary seats. I alone have been provided the lofty seat. All are being told, in effect, do have a look at a big animal from the zoo gardens. What arrogance, so foolish, so wicked. Have you ever seen such a big brute? Garlands of flowers have been put round his neck. What laudations, what bombastic, long-drawn, and hyperbolic adjectives. That's a good description, because the Gaudiya Math, they're really into that. The way they write, if you read their books. Long-drawn and hyperbolic adjectives. And how complacently, too, he is listening to the praise of his own achievements. How intently, and with his own ears, he also evidently feels delighted in mind. Is he not acting in plain violation of the teachings of Mahaprabhu? Can such a big brute, so selfish and insolent, be ever reclaimed from brutishness? I happen to be one of the greatest fools. No one offers me good advice on account of my arrogance. Inasmuch as nobody condescends to instruct me, I placed my case before Mahaprabhu himself. The thought occurred to me that I would make over the charge of myself to him and see what he would advise me to do. Then Sri Chaitanya Deva said to me, whomsoever thou meetest, instruct him regarding Krishna. By my command, being guru, deliver this land. In this thou wilt not be obstructed by the current of the world. Thou wilt have my company once again at this place. As the saying goes, having started on the dance, it is no use to draw close the veil. I am doing the duty of the guru, but if I preach that no one should shout jai to me, that is to say, if I say in a roundabout way, sing jai to me, it would be nothing short of duplicity. Our Gurudev has not taught us such insincerity. Mahaprabhu has not taught such insincerity. I have to serve God in the straightforward way. The word of God has come down to the Gurudev. I have to obey it in all sincerity. I will not disrespect the Guru at the instance of any foolish or malicious sectarians, especially as Sri Gurudev has directed me, saying, by my command, being Guru, save this land. This command has my Gurudev preached. My Gurudev, in his turn, has conveyed this command to me. I will not be guilty of any insincerity in carrying out that command. So what I finally decided on, I thought that I don't have to live up, I don't have to specifically ask people to speak homage. But it is nice that they speak. And so I have fashioned something which is personal, which is speaking to the Guru, but which is a little different. And what it emphasizes is that I'm trying to help you, to guide you in your eternal relationship with Krishna and Prabhupada, and help you to realize that. And I'll be pleased if you can achieve that. And Prabhupada will be pleased with me. This is connected also to our talk last night. What I'm going to ask you to speak. We were talking last night about serving according to your inclination. So here's the question that I'm going to ask you to speak on. What you hope to do in Krishna consciousness in the coming years, and how you hope that I'll be pleased by it, or how you hope I can help you accomplish it. It doesn't have to be like, you know, some practical plan that you're definitely going to be sure you'll achieve, or you'll be embarrassed if it doesn't happen right on time or exactly as you state. A little bit, it can be a dream or aspiration. What you hope to do in Krishna consciousness in the coming years, and how you hope that I'll be pleased by it, or how I can help you in accomplishing it. Is anyone who doesn't understand that? And of course, as usual, anyone who doesn't want to speak doesn't have to. Someone suggested that I just ask for hands, anyone who wanted to speak, but I think then all the shy ones will just back out. At least you can have the pressure of your name being called, and then you can say... You can say no or yes, and if you really want to speak but you just didn't have the boldness to raise your hand, then that's your chance when you get called.
You say nothing.
And as I said, it really does embarrass me to hear just like straight on praise of my qualities or something like that, but this, it'll be quite personal. I'll be interested to hear, because you are my disciple, what you're aiming for, and then how I have something to do with it. And I'll actually be pleased to hear it, and interested, and it's not just between you and I. All the other devotees are here, and it shouldn't be so embarrassing for you to state those aspirations in front of others. So maybe kind of a first experiment, but I want to give it a try.